Eye on the Arctic. Views from the North, I'm Elish Quinn. Well, Canada elected a surprise Liberal majority government last week, putting an end to the Conservative Party's 10 years in power. Now, the 78-day campaign, it was a long one, and dominant issues ranged from the Syrian refugee crisis to identity politics to terrorism. But climate issues were largely absent from the debate, especially when it came to Canada's northern regions, and even with the United Nations Climate Conference coming up later on this year. But these days, do politicians ignore climate issues at their own peril? Well, to help us answer this question, we've turned to an expert, Canadian research Matto Mildenberger. He's an assistant professor of political science at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and he specializes in the politics of climate change. He also recently co-authored an article titled, "Is Lagging on Climate Change a Political Liability?" on theconversation.com, and he joins me on the line from Santa Barbara, Matto Mildenberger, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. So first, the Canadian election. The dust is starting to settle. Give us some of your views on how much a role you think the outgoing Conservative government's climate and environmental policies played in their political defeat.
Well, I think it's certainly the case that the Conservative government's largely skeptical views on climate policy, their attacks on climate science and their defunding and marginalization of Canadian scientists likely played a role. I think that there are many Canadians who were quite frustrated with those developments. On the other hand, I don't think that climate change ever really broke through as a major issue during the election. And so I think that, you know, the defeat of the Conservative government probably rests more in other issue areas than it does in climate and the environment specifically.
And in the article, you compared the two of you, the Canadian results, to recent Australian political events. You know, give us a quick rundown of, you know, how they're familiar and any sort of patterns that we should be paying attention to.
Well, I think on the surface, they're quite familiar, as I'm sure many people in Canada followed. The Australian Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, was turfed in late September by a disgruntled party caucus. In Australia, unlike Canada, the parliamentary caucuses have the ability to change leaders at any point during a parliamentary term. So a simple majority of the backbench, for instance, can replace the party leader or even the prime minister. In that case, Tony Abbott was sort of a fairly prominent climate skeptic. I think that many in the environmental community saw him alongside Stephen Harper as being two of the most serious obstacles amongst OECD countries in driving forward a global climate agreement. And he was replaced by the new Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, who has a history of taking much more committed positions to climate policy. In fact, Turnbull had been kicked out of office himself several years ago for embracing emissions trading as a policy option. But I think, despite the fact that this is obviously good news for people who care about seeing progress on global climate policy, Abbott wasn't kicked out of office for his own climate political liabilities. So again, he was kicked out of office and turfed by his caucus for a wide variety of reasons relating to his leadership style, relating to his economic policies, relating to what people saw as his inability to manage a few difficult files in Australia. And so I think we need to see both the sort of the absence now of Stephen Harper and Tony Abbott suddenly from the global climate stage just a few months before the Paris conference on climate, more as a coincidence and maybe a fortuitous coincidence for people who want to see global climate change action. But I don't think it yet signals that taking anti-climate positions have really become a political liability for politicians quite yet.
And so let's look at the United Nations Climate Summit that's coming up next month. You know, what are you going to be looking for as the new Liberal government assumes power? And what role Canada will be playing at the conference?
Well, I think that so far, the moves of the new Liberal government have made are quite promising. I think that Canada is somewhat unique amongst advanced economies because of the enormous constitutional and regulatory authority that provincial governments have in the space of climate policy. And so I think that bringing back sort of a provincial-level delegation to accompany the Prime Minister to the Paris conference is certainly a promising development and a restoration of what had previously been the norm, in previous decades. I think it's likely going to be the case that any efforts to agree on climate policies and climate reduction targets need to happen domestically rather than simply happening during the Paris conference. I think it's definitely the case that we put a little bit too much stock into these international climate negotiations as being moments of real political movement. I think that there are moments in which we can entrench and sort of see the result of domestic politics that's unfolding in various countries around the world. And so very much Canadian climate policy action really has to result from discussions and conflict and conversations happening between the federal government and the premiers in Canada. And deciding to become serious about climate change and taking aggressive, ambitious action here. And I think that's going to unlock their ability to participate more fully in the international process. But I don't think we can assume that a global climate agreement is going to unlock climate policy here in Canada. That's going to have to happen through hard work and conflict and, political struggle here.
Then why do you think there is so much emphasis put on these big international meetings?
Well, I think it's partly about how we think about climate change as a problem. So, climate change is a really difficult problem. Some researchers call it a super wicked problem.
A super wicked problem.
That's right. That's even the professional jargon these days. So I mean, there's lots of really difficult elements in trying to come up with a solution to the climate problem. Right? So no individual country can solve climate change on their own. Right. So even if Canada were to reduce all of its emissions tomorrow and become sort of a net carbon zero country, that would have very little impact on the global climate trends because Canada's contribution to the global climate problem, like every other country, is just as one of many countries. So I think what that means is that people look to the international climate conferences as a way to try and manage and coordinate this collective action problem. Right? So if no individual country can solve the problem on its own, then there's a real imperative that everyone come together and cooperatively plan a way to manage the problem without anyone imposing, too many costs on themselves without seeing the benefits of those policy reductions. But at the same time, I think that focus on the international conferences, which has happened over the last two decades, has blinded us a little bit to the importance of national policy and political conflict over climate change. And so in some ways, it's not that the international meetings aren't important. It's that we can't really achieve progress at the international meetings until we've achieved political progress domestically. And we've seen this very much, for instance, in the way that the Australian or Canadian governments over the past decade have really tried to throw a wrench in the blocks of international climate negotiations because domestically, political power was concentrated among people who were less interested in seeing climate policy being enacted. And so I think it's more that we need to really take stock of where the political battles are being won domestically, not just in Canada, but across countries. And once there are enough of those battles that are being won by pro-climate individuals, that's when I really think we'll begin to see movement at the international level. So we shouldn't put the cart before the horse.
So finally, is lagging on climate change a political liability?
I think it's not yet, but I think that we may be getting to a point very soon where it begins to become that liability. I've done some research in the United States mapping the distribution of public opinion at local and state and congressional district levels. And in fact, for instance, there's a plurality of people in every single congressional district in the United States who do believe that climate change is happening. There's a plurality of people who support a number of climate policies, support for renewable energy, support for regulating carbon pollution. Now, that sort of broad-based support doesn't yet extend into, for instance, carbon taxes or a few more politically difficult policies. But I think that very much politicians would be wise to look to climate change as something they need to be on the right side of, because I suspect that in the coming years, it will become a political liability, even if it's only just beginning to be that now.
Matto Mildenberger, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.